Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey, you guys, welcome back to Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf, and I just want to say thank you. Guys, the response this last couple of weeks has been amazing. I can't even begin to tell you. I want to shout out a few people from Facebook this time around, people who have reached out with just such wonderful things to say. I want to thank Kevin Williams, Dana Wheeler, Mike Linville, Tracy Thompson, Rod Payton, Meja Martin, Justin Miner, David McInnich, Heather Hughes, Tana Fambro, John DeCirilla, Heli Kincanon, Matthew Foster, Angelique Rainey, Craig Worrell, Eric Peterson, Amber Crozier, Elamaris Gonzalez, Celeste Wolf, Matthew Sengstock, Danny Reese, Sheila Gillum, Jenny Shale, Bethan Briggs Miller, Liz Barkley, Beatrice Joe, Tracy Berger Davis, Victor Lee, and Amy Hood. I would thank the people from Instagram, but I don't know quite how to use Instagram yet, so I'm going to figure that out. But also, the names are a little weird. But I got to tell you, every comment I read and I treasure. Thank you so much. Before we begin tonight's show, executive producer Susan Lambert Haddam has asked me to issue this brief warning. In this episode, we do acknowledge that human beings have sex, and aliens too. So if there's kids or kid aliens around, maybe have them do something else. All right, here we go. Love in an Alien Purgatory by Farah Yurdozu. There comes a point in every alien abduction scenario that the mind cries bullshit. I am, of course, talking about the experiencer. Maybe it's when they first see the glowing disc hovering impossibly in the sky. Maybe it's when the beam of light sweeping the area somehow locks onto them. Maybe it's later, inside the craft, when they find themselves communicating telepathically with large-headed, black-eyed, non-human beings. Or during the horrifying parody of a doctor's visit when something is extracted or implanted. Maybe it's later, when it's over, when for the sake of sanity, the experiencer tries to convince themselves it never really happened. A friend of mine once described an intensely upsetting sound as difficult. Stories of alien abduction are difficult. The mind rebels. When I first turned my attention fully to the matter of alien encounters while I was writing the Mothman Prophecies, I went through a series of mental stages familiar to anyone who has suddenly decided to figure this UFO stuff out once and for all. Of course, I was always aware of UFOs and aliens. I grew up with Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of. My brother John and I saw all the Sun Classic International movies like The Outer Space Connection. And like anyone else in the late 1980s, I read Communion. But it wasn't until I was researching Mothman that I really decided, okay, I have to know. When you start this journey, you always place yourself on square one and arm yourself with the assurance that you're a reasonably intelligent person, and in short order, you will discover to your own satisfaction whether it is conceivable that extraterrestrials are visiting Earth. Because back then, you thought that's what it was all about. The first fork in the road is when you realize that some people who have studied this subject for decades suspect that the aliens are not extraterrestrials visiting Earth at all. They are not actual biological entities. They suspect that these aliens do not travel in nuts and bolts crafts from distant planets to visit us. They think the aliens have more in common with fairies and come to us from another dimension. Some people at this point mutter bullshit, and instead of taking this off-ramp into fairyland, they stay on the well-traveled road of what is called the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And if you do this, you end up having conversations about SETI and interstellar travel and crashed disks and reverse-engineered this and alien bodies that and government conspiracies and Avi Loeb and something called disclosure. I took the off-ramp to Fairyland. Fairyland is where you meet John Keel and Jacques Vallée and Patrick Harper and Joshua Cutchins and Jeffrey Kripal, and mill around in basements filled with books so old they never had jackets. And you smoke clove cigarettes and drink yellow and green liqueurs out of empty jelly jars. Oh yes, I know my people when I see them. I took this off-ramp because it made sense in my soul. Why work so hard to be literal when considering a subject so immaterial? And maybe the reason I'm seduced by thoughts of ghosts and Bigfoot and UFOs is because in some basic way I feel like maybe they're all the same. Misty and hidden and blurry at best, just the way I like them. I do not believe any government possesses physical proof of alien life, any more than I believe any government knows the secrets of life after death. I have no trouble trying to imagine a world that is, in reality, far stranger than anything I can imagine. And all I know for certain is that I used the word imagine 3 times in this sentence. Have you followed me to Fairyland? Have you noticed the paved off-ramp we took has turned to a gravel path, and now a dirt trail, and now nothing at all? Have you noticed how quickly the sun sets here? I have someone I'd like you to meet. His name is David Huggins. We're in his house now. David has been in almost daily contact with non-human entities since he was 8 years old. Some of them look like grays. Some of them look like 7-foot-tall praying mantises. Some of them look like miniature Bigfoots. One of them looks like a cross between the cover of Communion and Morticia Adams. And with her, David believes he has fathered over 60 alien hybrid children. It's too late for bullshit now. That was miles ago. Why not sit down? I'll light a fire. Let's hear what the man has to say. Farah Yurdozu is a Turkish ufologist who met David Huggins at a UFO conference in New York City in 2002. She had met other abductees and was familiar with many aspects of the abductee experience. But David's was unique, even in this rarefied group, because shortly after he regained conscious memory of his encounters in 1987, he began painting them. Farah's book, Love in an Alien Purgatory, 2009 Anomalist Books, is essentially David's pictorial autobiography, with Farah providing narrative detail and commentary. For the reader, it's like coming upon the strangest family album you've ever seen. There is something deeply unsettling about these paintings. They make the night gallery look like a Thomas Kincaid store at the mall. The style is primitive and the subject matter is so strange and the scenes they depict so lurid that it's actually physically upsetting to look at them. And impossible to look away. David Huggins is a pretty good painter, but he's no Andrew Wyeth. And it's this talented amateur quality that gives the paintings a disturbing feeling of truth and emotional authenticity. I brought this book with me earlier this year when Susan and I went up to Santa Barbara for one of our many anniversaries. We celebrate them all. Wedding day, engagement weekend, first date, first sex. What can I say? We're sentimental. Anyway, Susan saw the book and had a reaction. Come on, did you have to bring that? I told her I wanted to reread it for the podcast. She picked it up and flipped through it. She knew what was inside. Paintings of aliens, paintings of naked aliens, paintings of David naked having sex with naked aliens, paintings of their hybrid babies. This is not helping the mood, she said. Speak for yourself, I said. Susan and I have been together a long time. First as friends for over 15 years, then as something more. We met in 1985 as 18-year-old freshmen at USC. I looked like a young Matthew Broderick. She looked like a young Corey Haim. Hey, check out the show notes and tell me I'm lying. Was I attracted? Come on, who didn't love Lucas? Susan and I had seen each other around the Daily Trojan, USC's school newspaper, where we both worked. But the first time I ever talked to her was a few months later when we both took Native American Indians with Professor Joan Wybell Orlando. Susan was sitting a few rows ahead of me. She had on a denim Levi jacket covered in flair, but there was one button which got my attention. red letters on a white field that read, "Whatever happened to Guts?" Okay, get ready for a sad trip to Nerdtown. This button was an obscure reference to an episode of Hardcastle and McCormick, one of my favorite shows back then. Favorite like, I wrote a script for it, senior year of high school. It was a classic 1980s premise. A hard-nosed retired judge hires an ex-con he once put away to help him hunt down all the cases that got out of his courtroom on a technicality. And Whatever Happened to Guts is sort of his Reagan-era motto about not chickening out when something is really important to you. It seemed impossible that this button could exist outside that one episode of the show that I recognized it from, and even more impossible that someone I sort of knew had it. As soon as class ended, I went up to her and asked her about it. For the first time in my life, I got the Susan Lambert smile. It's like she'd been waiting all day for someone to ask her this particular question, and now she could finally answer it. It turned out that she had seen the Hardcastle and McCormick crew filming on campus one day last fall, and being Susan Lambert, she walked up and immediately made a friend. In this case, sound man Fast Eddie Mahler. A few hours later, as they were wrapping for the day, Fast Eddie gave her his phone number and invited her to stop by the sound stages in Culver City, where the other Stephen Cannell shows were filmed. She took him up on the offer and a few weeks later found herself hanging around with Dirk Benedict on the set of the A-Team. Anyway, it was during this time that she got the button. It's hard to describe the effect this had on me. I mean, I was completely obsessed with TV writer-producer legend Stephen J. Cannell. He was my hero. I grew up in Los Angeles and had never been near the actual production of any of his shows. But Susan Lambert, barely a month out of Atlanta, Georgia, had somehow penetrated to the very heart of the TV world I dreamed about every day of my life. Now, I'd like to say I fell in love with her that day, but I didn't. I fell into curiosity. And I fell into friendship. But the very thing that made Susan such a wonderful friend to almost everyone who met her was the thing that probably kept me from falling in love with her, at least back then. It was the fact that Susan was a basically happy human being. Kindness and optimism were her default mode. Sure, she had problems and frustrations and disappointments, and like all true artists, she has a dark side. But unlike most of us at film school, it wasn't the dark side that drove her. Susan was, by her own description, free and green and easy. And these are attractive qualities to people who are mentally healthy. But at the time, I wasn't. I didn't understand that a relationship didn't need to be hard. Since my relationship with my mother was so fraught from the day I was born, that was all I knew. I always felt like, somehow, my mother's whole emotional world was my responsibility. I had to take care of her. It was my job to maintain her moods. When I succeeded and she was happy, everything was okay. When I failed, she fell into an abyss and took me with her. Both our lives depended on me. For me, if it wasn't a matter of life and death, it wasn't love. So in Susan Lambert, I faced a real conundrum. I was attracted to her, but I couldn't see how I would ever be a serious component in her life. We dated for a while and had real feelings for each other, but something was off. I didn't need to save her. She didn't need to be saved. And I just didn't know what to do with that. And all the while, I continued to long-distance date the woman I eventually married. She was going to school in New Haven, which is code for Yale. Being separated from her was excruciating for me. It threatened my sense of identity. My role as self-appointed savior in her life was so important to me that being apart from her made my everyday life feel empty and beside the point. Like I was just marking time until I could be at her side again. Like a dog waiting for their owner to come back home from work. Susan and I graduated from USC and stayed friends and went on with our lives. I married my Yale girlfriend. We had two kids. My career slowly found its footing. I got into therapy. And ultimately, the marriage ended in 2001. But that's a story for another podcast. It was after all that that Susan and I eventually started dating again. But let's stay back in the 1980s for a moment. In 1987, right around the time Susan and I were going our separate ways, David Huggins' life was getting ready to explode. He was married at the time and the father of a young son. He was living in New York City. And the date August 17th, 1987 was looming in his mind. He didn't know why, but it felt significant. On the night of August 17th, 1987, he had a dream. In the dream, David saw something descend from the sky and land. A woman emerged from the object and approached David. She had large dark eyes and pale skin, black hair and a pointed chin. She was beautiful and exotic, and David felt a deep connection to her. He knew that he knew her, he just couldn't quite remember how. In the weeks following the dream, David felt his life slowly unraveling around him. Were there people following him, watching him, even inside his house? Something was definitely off. Weeks later, David found himself in a bookstore, glancing through a recently published book called Intruders, The Incredible Visitations at Copley Woods, by UFO investigator Bud Hopkins, Random House, 1987. David would later say he felt compelled to enter the bookstore and was somehow directed to that very book. We all know that feeling, don't we? It was while reading a chapter in this book entitled Other Women, Other Men, that described people who were convinced they'd had sexual encounters with alien beings, that a rush of memories suddenly flooded David's mind. Memories that went all the way back to his childhood in rural Georgia. And suddenly, he remembered how he knew the woman from his dream. She was an alien-human hybrid. Her name was Crescent. And one afternoon, in 1961, he and Crescent made love for the very first time in the woods behind his house. He was 17, and because of Crescent, he was no longer a virgin. So many memories, covering a span of over 36 years, going all the way back to his childhood. David was an art school graduate. He had always been creating art. And now he had the overwhelming feeling that they wanted him to paint his experiences with them. So he did, and does to this day. That afternoon in the woods with Crescent remains special to him. In the painting, he and Crescent are in the middle distance, surrounded by trees. David is naked and splayed beneath her in a position of complete submission, his head bent back and his face twisted in pain or fear or ecstasy, or all of these. He remembers intense sexual arousal, and he remembers her eyes and how close they were to his face before he passed out. 2 years later, at age 19, David moved to New York City to attend art school, and Crescent followed. At night, she would come to him in his small, shabby one-room apartment, and they would make love. Their coupling was efficient and clinical, and it was also impossible, and it felt completely real. But how could it be real? One night while walking back to his apartment, he saw a bouquet of flaming red cyclamens. He had an idea. I'll buy her some flowers. After all, she is my... what? Don't question it, he thought. Follow the impulse. Buy her the flowers. If she comes tonight and takes them, then she's real. If I wake up tomorrow and they're still sitting on the bookshelf, well, at least then I'll know. He bought the flowers and went home and left them on the bookshelf and went to bed. When he woke up the next morning, he had no memory of seeing Crescent the night before, and when he looked at the bookshelf, he only had a vague memory of putting something there the previous night. But the thought quickly left his mind. He was late for school. When he arrived at school, he passed a studio filled with students all painting floral arrangements, and suddenly he remembered the flowers. He had placed red cyclamens on the bookshelf, and they were gone. Crescent had taken them. She was real. That night, she came to him. As he prepared for sleep, he noticed a small light in the center of his apartment wall. It grew and grew into a large hole that opened up. An insect-like being, the size of a tall man, but in the form of an enormous praying mantis, stepped through the hole. Odd, even for New York. And then as he watched, Crescent followed through the hole and approached him and sat on his bed. They were very close. She looked at his bookcase, then back at him, and smiled. Something was happening between them. She pressed her forehead gently against his, and he knew in this moment that this was kissing in her world. And though they had made love many times, this was a new intimacy, and David immediately felt a special bond grow between them. She pushed him back onto the bed and removed his clothes, and then removed hers. And then, as was their custom, she mounted him. I should note that in every painting of their sexual encounters, Crescent is always on top of David. On this night, however, the sex was different, felt different. This time there was love. Crescent spread her body across him, and he could hear her making a soft, melodic, purring noise. He closed his eyes, and soon he felt his arousal growing past the point of control, felt himself coming, and all the while, the insect-like being stood in a dark corner of the room, watching them. It's Friday night, October 1st, 2004. Susan and I are in Santa Barbara for the weekend. We're at Paoli's Italian restaurant on State Street, in the bar, waiting for a table. I keep angling my groin away from Susan, which is the opposite of my usual behavior. You see, I have a ring box hidden in my pocket, and no, it doesn't look like I am happy to see anyone. It looks like I have a square testicle. I'm very self-conscious. I'm going to propose to her this weekend, and I don't have a plan. I haven't reserved a special table or hired a mandolin player. I haven't consulted with the chef to put the ring in her risotto. I'm acting on the advice given to me by the writer's room of a show called The Inside, which I just started on. They're the only ones who know what I'm planning to do this weekend, and the consensus was, just have the ring with you at all times, and when the perfect moment comes, boom, pop the question. This sounds great on Thursday in the writer's room, but now it's Friday night, and I'm nervous, and I'm lumpy, and she's having a great time because she has no idea what this weekend's all about. But she's made it clear over the last few months, if marriage is a real possibility, she doesn't want the old, well, let's discuss it and then go buy the ring together routine. She reverts to a southern accent she doesn't have and says, a girl likes to be asked. Susan and I are both 37. I'm divorced with two small boys, but she's never even been married, never been engaged. If it happens, she wants it to be special, and I want that too. I want it for her and me. All I have to do is wait for the perfect moment. Our cocktails arrive, gin and tonics, our drink. We lift our glasses and toast. And before I know it, I am asking the big question. Susan, do you believe in ghosts? She looks at me. Really? You already grilled me about this on our third date. Why am I doing this? Why am I asking her this question instead of the question? I guess I'm just looking for something to, I don't know, steer our conversation into something mystical and magical so that I can finally pull this box out of my pants and ask her to marry me. Here's the thing. It took so long for me to get out of my first marriage. When I finally did, a part of me believed that marriage itself was the enemy. It was an institution that forced people into unhealthy codependent relationships. Inside a marriage, no one could ever be their true, authentic selves. No one could ever be free. So why do it again? Why run back into a burning house? Plus, I'd never really dated around in my teens and 20s when normal people do that sort of thing. Now that I was single for the first time in my adult life, wasn't this the perfect time to go out and date a million people? Have casual sex like I imagined every other single adult on earth was doing? My plan was to do just that. For the rest of my life. The only problem with all of that was Susan. Our first date, post my divorce, was accidental. It was just supposed to be a friend thing. I had tickets to see Eric Bogosian speak at UCLA. Now, he'd been in Under Siege 2, Dark Territory, and I thought it would be cool to see him in case he talked about it. I didn't feel like being with a total stranger that night. I wanted to be with someone who knew me. So I asked Susan, and she said sure. So we saw Bogosian. Shockingly, he did not name check me or the movie, but we still had fun. And afterwards, we were hungry, so we went to the Mustache Cafe in Westwood and had dinner, plus a lot of gin and tonics. Later, when I dropped her off, I walked her up the steep staircase to the back house where she lived on a little street in Echo Park and asked if I could come inside for whatever. Something. Coffee? A nightcap? An ice cream sandwich? I was still pretty new at the seduction thing. But Susan got freaked out. I mean, sure, I was divorced, but mentally for her, I was still a married guy, or as she put it, in a box. So I guess like me, she had two competing emotions. I wanted to sleep with her, but only casually. And she wanted to sleep with me, but felt like I was somehow still off limits. Now, the sleeping together thing got settled fairly quickly, not that night, but soon enough after. And by then, we were actually dating. And guess what? It was great. Free and green and easy was suddenly the sexiest, most seductive thing I'd ever felt. It really, really worked for me. Every time I saw Susan, every time I touched her, it was like I was sliding into a warm, candlelit bathtub. I could feel the fear and anxiety melt off my body. When I was with her, I was calm and safe and warm and loved and happy. Which made everything so much worse because, of course, I knew I had to break up with her. Remember, I was never going to get married again. Ever. I was absolutely convinced that marrying Susan would destroy everything I'd accomplished by getting divorced. My strength and independence would turn into weakness and servitude. But I also knew that when I finally did end things with Susan, it would destroy her. So, either I get destroyed by marrying her, or she gets destroyed if I don't. Never underestimate my ability to make myself miserable. My therapist did the best he could. He reassured me that I wasn't just dating my ex-wife all over again, which I guess some people do. According to what I told him about Susan, he felt that she was a very different kind of person, and we were having a very different kind of relationship. To him, it sounded solid and healthy. Idiot. He really couldn't understand my pathological fear of marriage. He said, "Marriage can be whatever two people decide it should be." Can you believe I was paying for this bullshit? Didn't he understand that marriage was like getting locked in a bank vault with the air slowly running out? Didn't they teach him anything in therapy school? "Promise me you won't break up with her without talking to me first," he said. So I didn't. Not yet. I broke up with her 6 months later. We were having dinner at Hu's Szechuan restaurant with a big group of friends from USC, something we did every few months. I was talking to Melissa Morrison, who was telling me about her current boyfriend. I asked her if she had any plans to get married, and she said, "I'm not really the marrying kind." And I said, sort of joking, but mostly not, "God bless you. You hear that, Susan?" It was a terrible thing to say. And the minute I said it, I knew it was a mistake. I knew I'd hurt her. And it felt terrible. But in some other dark, self-destructive way, I was relieved because I knew I'd crossed a line. I was over the falls. The conversation I'd been dreading for 2 years was finally going to happen. Later that night at her place, we talked about ending things. Susan said that A, my comments seemed to imply that she was desperate to get married, which she wasn't, and B, my comments seemed to reflect my opinion that all marriages are bad. "If you really feel that way, maybe we shouldn't be together," she said. I said something honest, the most honest thing I could say. "I can't break up with you. I can't destroy you too." She asked me if I really thought I had destroyed my ex-wife by divorcing her. I heard how self-centered and grandiose that sounded. I said, "If leaving her didn't destroy her, then me marrying you will." Susan said, "I think she's a lot stronger than you give her credit for. And I don't get where all this destroy stuff comes from. Maybe you're afraid of being destroyed." Which, of course, I was. "If we break up," she said, "I'll just spend more time at work." Which, if you know Susan, is the most Susan thing she could possibly say. I will be very sad, she said, but I won't be destroyed. You don't have the power to destroy me. It was like a switch got flipped. I kept saying to myself, I can't destroy you. I don't have that power. I was having a sort of a breakthrough, but Susan just looked at me like I was insane. It would be very ironic if me finally realizing I want to marry her turns into the moment she realizes she doesn't want to marry me. I thought about what she just said. In reality, I obviously hadn't destroyed my ex-wife. She was working at her career and parenting our kids and going on about her life. And come to think of it, I hadn't destroyed my mother either. She was still alive and as happy as she had the ability to be. If no one else was getting destroyed, maybe I wouldn't be destroyed either. I finally told Susan about my fear. That getting married would crush some essential part of me, an autonomy I had finally earned by leaving my first marriage. How would being married be any different than what we're doing right now, she said. And she had a point. I wasn't sure. I just knew it would. That night we decided upon an experiment. We would act as if. Now, this is a psychological approach in which you imagine yourself already in the scary situation you're anticipating. What if I get fired? Well, okay, what if you do get fired? What if I get promoted? Well, okay, what if you do get promoted? Rather than just panicking about an imagined outcome, you start examining what would really happen if it came about. It's a useful trick because you realize pretty quick that the world doesn't end. Back in college, I felt like the only real relationships were the ones that felt like the end of the world. But I wasn't that guy anymore, so I act like him. If I'm a different guy, how about actually living differently? Why keep injuring myself in the same old ways over and over and over? Why not try something new? For me, acting as if brought immediate calm and order to my thinking. I was no longer driving straight at a brick wall. And by talking about my fears with Susan, I was able to let go of the idea that marriage was going to be the death of my independence or selfhood. I didn't want that, but she didn't want that either. She wanted me to be the person that I was right now, and I believed her. And as it turned out, Susan had some real reservations of her own. She loved the life she had for herself as a single woman. It was fairly uncomplicated. There was only one person to factor into any situation, herself. Now she would be adding me and my two kids. That was a big deal. An instant family was something she had never imagined, but now it looked like a real possibility. She went to the library to find books about being a single woman marrying a man with kids, but there weren't any. They were all about blended families, where each person was bringing children into the new marriage. Susan loved my kids, but she'd never been a parent, and that was going to change. For her part, all Susan was bringing to the marriage was her two dogs, Leia and Parker. I was good with dogs, and I could handle Leia. But Parker, that dog was messed up. Parker ate bees and chewed through fences and ran around the neighborhood for hours, uncatchable. Then he'd suddenly stop in the middle of the street and stare at a spot 6 inches in front of his face, contemplating his own mortality. Whenever Parker saw me, he'd jump up and lick my face like it was a pork-flavored popsicle. One day, I laid on the ground and told Susan I was just going to let him lick my face until he finally got his fill. She raised her eyebrows. Good luck with that. 10 minutes later, it was clear. He was just getting started. Maybe Parker had the power to destroy me. I pushed him away. You win, I screamed, and I went and took a shower. Meanwhile, David's relationship with Crescent was having its own unique ups and downs. One day, Crescent appeared in the interdimensional portal that now regularly appeared in his apartment wall. He could see her on the other side of the portal, holding a very small alien baby. She looked upset. Your baby is dying. David was shocked. What baby? Your baby, she said. It's dying. He could see her holding the infant under its arms and presenting it to him. Its larger-than-human head drooping to the side. You can't hold it like that, he cried. You have to cradle its head. He wanted to go through the portal. He had the intense desire to save the baby's life, but Crescent said he wasn't allowed. At that moment, he felt an overwhelming exhaustion sweep over him. He fell asleep, and when he woke up, he was with her. Now, in the past, they had sometimes met aboard her spaceship, and it had the sterile laboratory feeling familiar to many abduction reports. But now, he found himself in a very different environment, a kind of underground cave complex. And Crescent wasn't alone. Beside her and the baby, there were several other hybrid women, some small grays, and two of the insect-like beings, and they all seemed totally freaked out to see him there. One of the insect-like beings asked him what he was doing there. He explained he was here to see his dying baby, to hold him and try to save his life. He fell to his knees and begged the insect. David was crying, howling with grief that felt all-consuming. The hybrid women and the grays seemed confused by this display, as if they weren't familiar with human emotions. But as David's anguish grew, they too became upset. The hybrid women were especially affected by his behavior. The insect insisted that David should leave, but the women interceded on his behalf, and finally, he was allowed to stay. In his paintings depicting these scenes, David is very good at suggesting hints of human emotion on the faces of non-human beings. With alien faces, not to mention giant bugs, there isn't always a lot to work with. Sometimes just a tilt of the head is enough to convey puzzlement, frustration, confusion, or disapproval. In subsequent paintings, we see Crescent bring the ailing baby to David and place it in his arms. As soon as David touches the baby, it's as if energy is transferred from him to the hybrid infant, and the baby's health improves immediately. Seeing this, the insect-like being brings David into what David calls the incubator room. Here, dozens of hybrid infants are seen laying behind a glass partition in cubbyholes on shelves mounted in a large wall. The insect-like being communicates to David that these are all his children, and now he must touch them and give them the life energy. David does, but at the end of the process, he is drained and exhausted. The insect-like being brings him into another chamber where David sees a large doorway with milky golden light pulsating inside it. The light seems to have physical form. It oozes around the edges of the doorway. David is told to enter the light. At first, he doesn't want to, but the bug insists, so he does. He stays for a few minutes before losing consciousness. He wakes up the following day in his apartment feeling energetic and healthy, and the feeling lasts for weeks. When memories of these events came flooding back to David in late 1987, he was married and had a small child, his son, Michael. He was deeply frightened by the nature of these memories, and yet he never doubted their reality. Once he started to remember, it seemed to answer more questions about his life than it raised. Suddenly, things made sense. He'd had a deep, decades-long relationship with Crescent that was still ongoing. How was he supposed to integrate all that with his other life in New York with his wife and child? According to Farah, David had a strong feeling that the aliens wanted him to do paintings about his experiences with them, and if he did, he would, in a way, be going public about an aspect of his life that his family knew nothing about. All we know from interviews conducted later was that David tried to explain what had been happening to him to his wife Janice, but once he began talking about alien abduction, she shut him down. And soon after that, they got divorced. David went ahead and did his paintings, and he's been doing them, hundreds of them, for more than 20 years. There have been small gallery showings in New York. Attendees seem fascinated by the paintings and by David. In a great documentary about his life and paintings, Love and Saucers by Brad Abrahams, we see David as the quiet, serious, reflective artist that he is. He also comes across as warm, sincere, and relentlessly normal. but he is also a man who has been through the ringer twice. The first time was when he had the experiences, and the second time was reliving them while creating his art. He says that doing the paintings has brought him relief from the fear of the encounters. He was traumatized, but the paintings calmed him down. By doing them, he found he was able to face what had happened to him, understand it, control it, frame it. After months of acting as if, I knew it was time to ask Susan to marry me. And so back in 2004, we were in Santa Barbara, and I kept waiting for the perfect moment to come so I could finally get that ring out of my pants and make things official. Now, I didn't do it that first night at Paoli's. It just didn't feel right. Plus, I thought proposing on night one might make the rest of the weekend seem somehow anticlimactic. The next day, we saw a matinee of Shaun of the Dead, and we were both completely blown away. But it left us feeling tense and giddy and keyed up. Plus, it was a zombie movie where the lead character can only get the guts to ask his girlfriend to marry him because it's the end of the world. We went out to dinner, but the perfect moment never came. The next morning, I tried to arrange breakfast outside by the ocean, but Susan wasn't hungry, and we both had to get back, and pretty soon we were in the car heading home. Desperate, and apparently acting weird, I pulled off the 101 and headed up a side road into the hills above Santa Barbara toward a place I found out later was called Rattlesnake Canyon. I thought maybe fortune would smile on me and I'd somehow stumble on an amazingly scenic spot. I mean, come on, it's Santa Barbara. But I just kept driving further and further into the canyon. First, I wanted to pull over and stop on this bridge, but Susan stopped me. After all, there was no shoulder. Getting out of the car on a two-lane bridge was a bad idea, I guess. We ended up looping down and arriving underneath the bridge. Panicking, I parked, got out, and said we should take a walk. Just Susan and I, alone, heading into the brush in the shadows beneath a bridge. God only knows what she thought I had planned. This is just awful, I thought. How could you have screwed this up so badly? We suddenly found ourselves in a cloud of bugs hovering over some illegally dumped garbage. I guess that was it for her. She turned around to head back to the car and saw me kneeling in the weeds, looking at her and holding the ring box up between us. It took her about 2 seconds to put it all together. Then she smiled and said, "Oh, okay. Let me ask," I said. "I've heard that a girl likes to be asked." Now that we were on the same page, I calmed down a little. I said, "I've been wanting to do this all weekend. I just kept waiting and waiting for the perfect moment." We looked around at the garbage and the bugs and the traffic roaring past on the bridge above us. "But with you," I said, "every moment is the perfect moment." Then I asked her to marry me. Now it's October 2023, back in Santa Barbara once again, and the restaurant that used to be Paoli's Italian is now Loquita, a Spanish tapas place. I have no ring box in my pocket tonight. That was 19 years ago. Tonight we're seated on the patio. It's a warm, dry evening. The plumeria all along the walls smell like night-blooming jasmine. Our drinks have changed from gin and tonics. She has a bee's knees, basically gin and honey. I have something that's red and frothy and has flowers in it and smells like my grandmother's purse, and the waiter hands it to Susan first before realizing it's mine. We toast. Then I pop the question. "Susan, why am I doing this podcast?" Susan says, "Well, I thought you said Scott and Forrest told you to." I say, "No, not exactly." We talk for a bit about how scary it can be to really put yourself out there. She's been doing a podcast of her own for over a year, 80s TV Ladies, all about female-driven TV shows of the 1980s. But we agree, mine's different. I'm talking about myself and other people, real people from my life. I've been a writer for over 40 years, but I've never done anything like this, nothing this personal. Nothing this real. What if someone gets mad at me, I say. This is something I struggle with. If someone's mad at me, I feel like that makes me a bad person. Susan tells me that's not true. She peruses the menu. Besides, she says, I'm mad at you all the time and you're fine with it. She has a point. Just promise me you're not going to put me in the episode with the weird alien paintings. Okay, I say. You already did, didn't you? Yes. We order our food and watch the sunset over the white adobe buildings across the street, and we try to remember how we felt 19 years ago. Susan says, I was having a good time until you drove me up into the canyons and tried to murder me. I was trying to be romantic, I say. I look at my wife and I wonder what I was so worried about. Not her, I realize. I was worried about me. And of course I still am. Who's going to give a shit about me talking about my life? Even worse, what if what I say upsets someone? What if they get mad at me for talking about them? You're right, Susan says. Forget about the podcast. You shouldn't do it. Our food arrives. The patio is in shadow now. Small white lights glow all around. Our table has a candle. No one is going to be destroyed by this, okay? Not even you. You know that, don't you? I look into the dark night sky. I try not to be afraid. After all, what is there to be afraid of? I look back at Susan, who's smiling that Susan Lambert smile, and I know what she's thinking, because I'm thinking it too. Whatever happened to guts? Farah Yardozu ends her book about David Huggins like this. David Huggins has been asked a version of this question many times. What do you say to people who don't believe that any of this really happened? David always answers the same way. I'm just telling what I remember by painting pictures from different periods of my life. If nobody wants to hear me, it's okay. If someone wants to know, I'm ready to share my story. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Next time, make sure to grab your Polaroid camera and a bottle of scotch as we dive into the world of Ted Cirios. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.